Hi folks, and welcome to episode 38 of the Epochs of the Lotus Eaters. I'm joined, as always, by Beau, and today we are going to be talking about Solon, the absolutely real lawgiver of Athens. One of those characters that I can actually firmly put my thumb and go, no, this guy was real. Unlike Romulus.
Yeah, no, there's no historians that say he's fictional or even semi-fictional. He seems to be fully in the light of history. Although our sources are kind of poor, he's definitely existed, it seems. Yeah.
And he wasn't a villain. Which is nice.
Yeah, no, he seems to be sort of an all right guy.
Yeah, well, that's a start if you're going to have a lawmaker, isn't it? You know?
Yeah, yeah. I do sometimes think that a good way to judge historical figures is, would you be comfortable just having a conversation or a meal with them or a drink with them? And I think, I do think...
Romulus, that, no. Solon, maybe.
I think Solon would be fine. Although he does seem, we'll get into it a bit, but he had some ideas that to the modern mind are a bit... very, very harsh and old-fashioned.
I mean, even Aristotle did, really. You
know? Yeah.
So, I mean, it's not surprising. But
well, just one quick example of it is he thought that acting and plays were sort of dishonest to the point of being bad, you know.
Based, yeah.
Yeah. If we allow this sort of fiction to go on, it can sort of corrupt our souls.
And look at what Hollywood's doing right now. I mean, I'm just saying, maybe Solon had a few points. But but at least he wasn't like, well, slavery's natural. You know, thanks, Aristotle. You know, maybe it is, but, you know, it doesn't make it good, does it?
Well, Solon largely does away with slavery. That's one of his things. But slavery of actual full Athenian citizens. But we'll get into what we really mean by that.
Yeah.
It's not exactly the same as sort of, you know, the cotton picking South style of slavery, of course. But okay, well, jumping just straight in, like I said, our sources on this aren't superb. Of course, we've got the life of Plutarch, and once again, we should be drawing largely from Plutarch's account. But Herodotus talks a fair bit about it. Philo of Halicarnassus talks about it. Aristotle's got an essay all about it, or, well, all about the constitution of Athens, of which big chunks talk about Solon. And we've actually got a fair amount of Solon's poems himself survive.
Oh, excellent.
Because before he was ever a statesman or a military commander, he was a poet, or sort of a wannabe poet. And so a fair few of those survive, which is sort of incredible. And then beyond that, we've got scraps. So it's not actually all that good. And as anyone who's been watching the last few will know, Plutarch's writing in sort of the first century AD.
Yeah.
So it's 600-700 years after Solon was supposed to have lived.
Yeah. So this is good. Plutarch's... account of it is as close to this to Solon as my account of like the Hundred Years' War.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
So, you know, take from that what you will.
Yeah. So that's something we should point out is that this is before the age of Pericles.
Yes.
I think if you're sort of
The Persian invasion.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's barely out of like the Archaic era, isn't it?
That's right. You
know, it's like what 600 or 700 BC.
Yeah.
So this is, I mean, this is before Athens is a democracy. This is a very sort of, it's a quite a murky period, isn't it?
Yeah.
Where we have stories of what happened, but it's hard to pin it down as like what kind of society it was, I find.
Yeah, no, definitely. Solon is sort of credited with being the, a lawgiver, just like Lycurgus, but the man who brought democracy to Athens and the world. I mean, it's more complicated than that, really. But nevertheless, that's
he's the start of all the problems, guys.
Right. So I think if you're new to Athenian history or ancient Greek history, the two big figures for Athens, in my mind, in most people's minds, are Pericles and Solon. Pericles enjoyed sort
Coral
of Themistocles
not
age.
Getting a look in here.
Yeah, there's loads of others, aren't there? Of course.
Yeah, there are loads.
I'm not even talking about philosophers or playwrights, but actual statesmen, Cleomenes. Yeah. I mean, Draco is one of them, Draco. So that's one of the things, just to mention Solon's date. He was supposed to be born around 630 BC and died around 560 BC. And so the golden age of Pericles is really more in the 400s, isn't it? And the generation after.
Yeah.
So like the age of Plato and Aristotle and all stuff. So they would look back at Solon as sort of a founding father in a sense.
Yeah.
And so they held him in very, very high regard. Mm-hmm. I suppose that's come down to us to this day.
Yep.
The big two names, I suppose, are Pericles and Solon, but you could do worse than starting with Solon.
Yeah. But we are talking, you know, hundreds of years of history, of a continuous history of an independent and proud state.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things where it's like, well, you're just kind of arbitrarily picking a place. But Solon seems like a good place to start because of the situation he finds himself in before he becomes a lawmaker, right? Because they're laboring under Draco's laws, as I understand it. And it's from Draco that we get the word draconian.
Yeah, meaning, of course, extremely harsh.
Yes.
Sort of arbitrarily harsh about things. So, yeah, I mean, when I did my undergrad, the first lecture on, like, a course on ancient Greece would be Solon.
Hmm.
And I was watching a lecture the other day, just brushing up on all this stuff, from an actual university professor, and he said the same. My first lecture on Greece is Solon. So it's a great place to start.
Yeah, I watched, was it Donald Kagan's lectures on, the Yale lectures on ancient Greece years ago now. I watched them, but they were fantastic.
Yeah,
they're
Donald all Kagan's great.
Yeah, he is good. They're all available, and you should go and watch them if you've got the time.
Mm-hmm. So I suppose Solon's story, one place to start it, is with its sort of juxtaposition with Draco. So Draco was also an Athenian statesman in about the generation before, not a fantastic amount of time before Solon supposed to have lived. And Draco, the main takeaway, the headline of him, is that everything was punishable by death. That's the main thing. So he set up sort of a constitution. there was already sort of, according to Aristotle, Draco's reforms were already like the second or possibly third number of reforms. Like he attributes one to Theseus.
Yeah.
And well, so anyway, and Draco's
they're obviously trying to figure out, okay, what's actually a good set of laws to live under? Draco's like, well, we should just kill anyone who breaks the law.
Yeah, yeah. Nearly everything was punishable by law. You know, even stealing very small amount of things is punishable by law. Punishable by death, sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
And apparently when asked about that, he said, well, no, I just think death is the punishment for all these minor crimes, and there's nothing worse to give out for worse crimes. So it's just death.
And we assume this was an effective punishment.
Well, yeah. People have said that in Draco's time, and our sources are a bit scant, but in Draco's time, it seems to have been there was a lot of social unrest. People being murdered in the streets for political reasons. The equivalent of sort of home invasions and murders and all sorts of nastiness.
Right. So this didn't just come out of Draco's desire to see people hanging.
No, right.
This came out of a very deep imperative to bring about order.
Yes, yes. Yeah, it's not just Draco's, just a massive...
lunatic.
Yeah, yeah. It seems like it was almost a reasoned response to pretty much something approaching anarchy, the bad type of anarchy. real anarchy.
Yeah.
So one of the main things that Solon is famous for is being a lawgiver, but really reforming Athens' constitution, reforming lots and lots and lots of things, the economy, just the way business is done, the way politics is done, the morals, all sorts of things. And I suppose one of the first things that gets said about it is that he repealed everything of Draco's,
really?
Apart from the laws surrounding homicide, which were obviously death.
Yeah.
So they can be kept.
Yeah.
But nearly everything else he reformed. Because it was just, it wasn't really working for people anymore, you know.
I was just really hungry. Well, now you're just really executed.
Yeah. Well, there's this thing even in modern day in certain systems of law, like Sharia law, the punishment for theft is a hand.
Yeah.
Your hand will
be
locked off.
What's the punishment for adultery and things like that? Quite harsh.
I don't, in Sharia law, often, isn't it, it's up to the families of the victims to decide.
Oh, is it?
Sometimes, yeah. Up to and including the exact punishment that the criminal did themselves. So, for example, I was just a slight aside, but I watched it the other day. It was on one of Simon Whistler's criminology videos. But there was a guy in Pakistan who murdered loads of people and put them in acid baths. The bodies in acid baths. And the judge ordered that he should be put in an acid bath.
Well,
which is consistent with...
Sure, the Lex Talonis, it's absolutely consistent.
An eye for an eye, sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But that didn't actually end up happening out of interest. Anyway, back to Solon.
Pakistan's a very interesting place, isn't it?
Yeah.
Anyway, moving on.
So Solon himself is an interesting halfway house between being a rich aristocrat and a poor, normal person.
Right, okay. That's
sort of a big part of his story. So he comes from an aristocratic family, but one that had no money. Apparently his dad gave away nearly all their wealth upon his death.
Thanks, Dad.
Yeah. Thanks for nothing.
I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm going to do the same for my kids. But, you know, then I'm being rich, spoiled brat. Not that I'm rich. But anyway, let's assume I'm rich. Come on.
Yeah, so he was from a noble family, but yeah. one that had no money. So when the time comes, we'll get to it in a minute, he was sort of accepted by both. I mean, some of his early poetry was, it was very much in the tone or in the vein of the, I'm a man, a poor man of the people. But when it comes down to it, sort of both, there was no such thing as a middle class, of course, sort of quite a modern thing to have an established, well-defined middle class. But if there is any such thing, maybe he belonged to it because he was accepted in the upper echelons, although not really part of the club, but accepted, which is enough. You know, like the idea that he, to be the highest magistrates, the archons in Athens, you would need to be, you need to be of a higher social status. And although he had no money, he was of that. And yet the fact that he lived very frugally and didn't covet wealth in any way endeared him massively to the normal people. So that's sort of one of the things about Solon that is sort of comes up and is sort of very important.
But man of decent character is what I'm hearing from this.
Yeah, yeah, it seems to be.
Not avaricious and grasping or, you know, scheming. You know, a man who's relatively content with what he has.
Yeah, some of his earliest poetry is saying things like rich people aren't necessarily, wealthy people aren't necessarily rich of spirit.
This is quite a common theme among many Greek philosophers, though, that precede him, not precede him, where, you know, lots of Stoic thought is basically, you know, if you have few desires, then you're very wealthy.
Right, yeah, yeah. Isn't probably getting some of this wrong, but one of the cornerstones of Buddhism, isn't it, is to don't covet things because you'll only be disappointed.
I'm not an expert in Buddhism. All right. I don't know much about it at all, actually.
One of the things the Buddha said was, you know, if you have desire for things, when that's not fulfilled, it's just going to lead directly to unhappiness. So don't desire them, don't covet them, just do without sort of thing.
So it's not wrong.
Yeah, yeah. He didn't think that wealth was necessarily measured in money.
So, put it that way.
And another thing is that back in his day, the idea of being a trader or trading the things merchants. Was, yeah, the merchant class was sort of considered fairly lowly or dirty or sort of no aristocrats that are noble at birth shouldn't really be engaged in that sort of thing. And he said, no, that's nonsense. Athens needs commerce. Yeah. We need money. We don't really produce much.
Well, they don't grow anything in the soil, do they? You know, for anyone who doesn't know, Attica is pretty barren. It's not a fertile area. And Athens' position geographically actually really well situated as a trading town, you know. And so they tended to producing things like pottery that was very popular. You know, Attic pottery is very, very popular and then traded everywhere. And various other, you know, craftsmanship was a big deal there and as a commercial hub.
And it becomes a cultural hub, doesn't it, of course?
More
in really Pericles' age and the generation after. But it all sort of starts, it all sort of kicks off with Solon, where you're allowed to sort of write whatever you want within reason.
Because there is an understandable kind of disdain for the merchant, I think, in just generally in history. I mean, in like ancient Japan, they were just considered the lowest class of people. Because this is a person who's not actually making anything with his own two hands, you know. Is just someone who's moving something from one to another and then profiting from the moving of the thing. And that I can see why that's got a kind of disdain to it. It's like,
I mean, I don't want to get all angles about it, but they're exploiting other people's work, right?
That's how it comes across. You know? It's not the skill and the labor of the artisan. It's just a man who carries it on a horse to somewhere else.
But as you said, Attica is quite poor or barren, or even in the age of Pericles, most people sort of struggled to make... To grow enough food for their own family, let alone massive surpluses that they can start selling off or in some sort of international
it's not
trade
Egypt.
Or anything like that. Right, you know?
It's not Mesopotamia. In fact, for a lot of the history of Athens, they had to import grain from the Crimea, didn't they?
From wherever they could.
Yeah, just to be able to feed them, which is one of the reasons they needed a giant navy to secure their own grain supply. So, yeah.
And it's one of the reasons why Solon says, look, let's sort of do away with our distaste of trade because we really need it.
Yeah.
In fact, if we're honest with ourselves, it's going to be sort of vitally important to our economy.
What options do we even have?
Yeah. You know? Right.
Got to be realistic, don't you?
Yeah. So it's things like that, sort of really quite broad strokes of the brush that Solon has. He gets given extraordinary powers. Let's get onto that relatively quickly. Before he sort of achieves these sort of extreme high offices, there's a couple of sort of stuff, fairly important stories from early, slightly earlier in his life. Okay. As I mentioned, he was a poet, sort of an amateur poet, at least, to begin with. But later in his life, his poems are imbibed very deliberately with sort of philosophical and political tone undertones. Yeah. But to begin with, it's just sort of for fun. Hmm. But he is known as a poet. One story is on his travels. Well, Plutarch gives us this story relatively early on in his account, but it must be from later in his life, where someone tells him that one of the young men of Athens has been killed or has been driven to death by the populace, and Solon keeps asking questions about it, and it transpires that it's his son.
What, Solon's son?
Yeah.
Oh, bloody
hell. And he starts sort of, you know, the classic mourning, sort of scraping at your face, pulling your hair, pulling your beard, all that sort of thing. And then the person says, actually, it's not. That was a lie. I've made that up. But the moral of this is... weird, but the moral of this is how best to deal with the uncertainties of life.
Right.
Really. The idea that people wouldn't ever have children or get married or take the big risks in life because they're scared of failing. Mm. The point of the story is maybe a tiny bit lost on us, a little bit, but the point of the story is don't be afraid of that sort of thing. You've got to do it anyway. Mm. And...
But that's a point that I think resonates with us now, because I do think that a lot of young people these days are in a position where they're looking and thinking, well, I'll probably just fail anyway. I'm not going to bother. And, you know, there's a lot of demotivational factors and forces in our society that are completely like load the mental processes of a person against taking risk. Mm. We're a very risk averse society at this point. Mm. And I really kind of despise it. I love taking risks. Mm. You know, sometimes they pay off, you know.
Yeah, right. Yeah, no, it's like you have to, right? Otherwise, you would just be in your room the whole time.
Exactly. Well, you accomplish nothing, and you don't have any of the nice things that you have. Like we'd have to go back to our old jobs. You know, I would not have had a YouTube channel. You'd still be working in finance or whatever it is. Mm. We wouldn't be able to like sit down and get paid to talk about Solon.
Yeah,
you know, and so like I think that's actually quite a pertinent point that he's making there.
And he just goes on to a tiny bit more detail on that, is that you should not only be not afraid of these things, but don't be too attached to them, because that's just life.
Yeah.
So for example, he says the correct response really should have been to the news that your son has died is to be upset, of course, but don't wail and bawl and pull your hair out or anything.
Have a bit of self-control.
Yeah. And he says the opposite of that is when you see someone who's their favourite horse or their dog has died, and they're inconsolable, crying and blubbing. Yeah. That's wrong. They've lost perspective a bit there. Anyway, again, it's just one little anecdote which Plutarch puts in, but sort of gives the measure of the man that he's dealing with. Yeah, not just like the minutiae of law, but the vast sweep of how to live almost. Yeah. So Solon is very important. When Herodotus, you know, for example, says he's very important, it's true. It's hard to deny.
Which is interesting as well, because he sounds like he's a man that's aiming for moderation, sort of in the sort of Aristotelian fashion, which I find is ironic, considering the Athenians I would classify as a bunch of extremists. Like, I mean, the Spartans were also a bunch of extremists, but the Athenians were also a bunch of extremists, just in the other direction. So it's just very interesting how they didn't moderate themselves.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose to cut to the chase, or one of the big things to take away about Solon and his life is that at one point, not too long from now, they wanted him to essentially be king. They wanted him to be sort of formally a despot or a tyrant. Mm. And he said no. and that's, you know, that's fairly rare when people, when you're given on a platter, executive power to say no to it is quite something.
I'm thinking of the sword of Damocles, though.
Right.
You know, he's probably like, wow.
Yeah, he realised it was a poison chalice of some type.
Yeah, exactly. That's, if I was ever offered that, I'd be like, no thanks.
Yeah.
I just don't think it'll end up winding out in my favour.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if you could tell Augustus that his, for example, that his quest to become sole ruler of Rome would lead to his entire family being murdered within a couple of generations.
Yeah.
Would he still do it? I don't know. Who knows? But
exactly.
So anyway, there's at this point, Athens doesn't have any sort of empire to speak of whatsoever.
No,
that's a bit later. And in fact, one of the island of Salamis, which is right near Athens,
it's literally just off the coast.
Yeah, it's right there. Yeah. Later becomes sort of synonymous almost with Athens in the way itself, that if Salamis falls, then Athens is doomed.
Well, and some of her greatest victories are at Salamis.
Exactly. Yeah, and it's right there. But at this point, they still hadn't conquered it or bested it.
Well, they were considered a total, like, no account power at this point.
Mm.
They're an independent state because everyone was. But, like, they had no military glory under their belts. You know, no one thought of them as anything impressive. And no one cared what happened in Athens.
Mm.
Like, no one cared.
It's just one of the other city-states, one of the other polis in Greece at this point. Yeah, it's not dominating anyone.
No.
In fact, they're kind of fighting with Megara over Salamis, and Megara's fairly sort of in between Sparta.
A small, inconsequential place that nobody cared about.
Mm.
And the Athenians can't even beat them easily.
Yeah. Well, they're having a war on Salamis and lose, get booted off.
Oh, there we go.
And so the Athenian state decide to pass a law censoring any mention of it. You're just not allowed to mention Salamis.
One of the biggest copes in all of human history.
Yeah, yeah. It's a really bad cope. You're just not allowed to mention it in just speaking in public or writing anything about it. You're not allowed to.
Right.
And their rationale was that it would just sort of stoke further conflict. And if we just let it be, hopefully we can just sort of move on. But anyway, the youth of Athens, of which Solon is a member at this point, because the classic vision of Solon is an old man, a great wise old man. But at this point, he's young, and him and his compadres are not happy with that.
Mm.
And so in order to sort of kind of get around this law, Solon pretends he's mad. And for a few days, he tells all his friends to tell everyone that he's lost his mind. He goes around the agora and places just saying random, nonsensical, gibberish things to make people think he's mad. And then, after a few days of this, comes out and in the middle of the agora, the marketplace, reads out this poem effectively saying, let's go back and addressing the Salamis thing. It's too disgraceful that we got booted out of Salamis. Let's go back and do it.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.